getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
This was the first of 10 books about the Duc de Richelieu and his three friends, Simon Arran, Rex Van Ryn, and Richard Eaton. They have become known as those modern musketeers, and of course their characters were inspired by those of Alexandre Dumas.
We've got a special look at investigative journalism coming up in about 10-15 minutes. It's Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, the big news this week has got to be what's been going on in Yemen. Now, we reported this just after Christmas, things like the president being kept under house arrest, very little reporting of what was going on. And then literally about a week ago, special forces from the West were drawn out. Now, what do these have to do with it? Because I wonder if, you know, we're told this is a Saudi operation. Is it? What's really behind all this?
Well, I mean, obviously, I've been reading about it and trying to understand what's going on. What you've got to remember is that Yemen was originally two states. South Yemen was a Marxist state set up by the National Liberation Front, and they drove out the British in 1967. And then the North Yemen was a more conservative Muslim state aligned with Saudi Arabia. But, of course, the Houthis are a kind of Shiite, and one of the problems for the Saudis is that the oil wells and the oil fields are there in majority Shia areas in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia isn't really a country, it was kind of invented by the British at the end of World War One to get access to oil, and the Americans then took over the franchise, and it's actually a very fragile state. It's got no real basis, and of course there's a far bigger population in Yemen than in the whole of Saudi Arabia, even though Yemen's quite a small place compared to Saudi Arabia. But I mean, the potential for massive conflict across the Middle East is now clear. We're now seeing the two sides lining up, the Sunni Shia axes on both sides, the West supporting. The West has supported Saudi Arabian intervention in Yemen, just as they supported the Saudi army invasion of Bahrain a few years ago. Now, we're talking about what's going on in Ukraine, invading, blah, blah. There was no doubt about it. The Saudi army crossed into Bahrain and started bulldozing Shia mosques and torturing and executing people with the support of the British government. Just as the British government is now supporting Saudi Arabia, which is an unelected dictatorship's intervention in Yemen. And of course the Iranians, who are sympathetic to the Houthis, are saying, well, look, you know, you've got no business sticking your finger in here. And it's a very complex situation on the ground in Yemen. You've got lots of different forces at work. You've got the previous president is supporting the Houthi rebellion. The guy who's been forced out now, nobody knows where he is. But the Houthis have also been fighting Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is a sort of ISIS kind of type organisation. And of course, everybody in the Middle East sees these ISIS type organisations as being aligned with the West. That's not the way the Western media presents it, but in the Middle East, that's how it's seen and understood. And I think the evidence has been piling up that ISIS is definitely a front organisation.
Well, what evidence have you got for that?
Oh, well, there's loads of it. Listen, in the run-up to the whole chemical weapons attack at Ghouta 2 years ago...
that was before we'd ever heard of ISIS.
Yes, but I mean, the point is that the ISIS came out of those militant groups inside Syria who'd been armed and trained by Western intelligence services, including the Turks, the British, the Americans. I mean, the British have just sent a load of special forces to Turkey to train terrorists to overthrow the government of Syria, which did in fact have a democratic election and won. They only had 51% turnout, but they won of that 51%. Now, in other words, this is all very complicated. And in Tikrit, you've now got the Iraqi army fighting alongside Shia irregulars and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to retake Tikrit. And the Americans are bombing on their behalf, although the Iraqi government says, we don't want you to bomb on our behalf. The Iraqi government, the democratic government supposedly, is going to be supporting the Houthis because they're Shias. And in other words, the whole Middle East is about to go up, and this is absolutely the result of the disastrous invasion of Iraq in 2003, for which Tony Blair was responsible in British terms. And people think, oh, well, that was a big mistake, but now we can all go home and have a nice cup of tea. And I have to tell people listening to this radio show, that's not the way it works. We collectively decided to go to war with Iraq in 2003, and now the blood bill is going to come due, and it won't be pleasant.
Okay, what about AFRICOM and these basically instruments of US influence? We're talking about US AFRICOM and US CENTCOM, because there are these kind of behind the scenes, these big organisations which have a great deal of influence on what's happening militarily in places like Africa and the Middle East.
Well, the aspiration of the people running US and therefore British foreign policy is complete spectrum dominance. So they have AFRICOM, CENTCOM. In other words, the NATO US military has a control grid over the whole planet, and they are pushing their agenda in Ukraine, in Syria, in Venezuela. And they will know that their puppet has just been overthrown in Yemen, so they're now responding to that. But the potential for major conflict is there. And, of course, we've also got the economic situation underpinning all of this. This is very, very bad news. I mean, we've been carrying out drone attacks, completely illegal drone attacks in these countries for years. Yemen was a very poverty-stricken country. See, when Saudi Arabia was set up, they excluded Yemen because it was populous. Saudi Arabia at the time was relatively unpopulated, rural, not to say, desert region, and therefore all the oil wealth went to the hands of the Al Saud family and their acolytes. Whereas, of course, that oil wealth in that peninsula should have been used to raise living standards in Yemen. It never was.
And I notice also that the Iranians and the Syrian government have also been shooting down quite a lot of American drones and finding out quite a lot about what's going on.
Well, not only that, both the Iranian and Iraqi governments have said they've been shooting down British and American planes delivering weapons to ISIS. Now, they may be lying about that, but that is what they are saying. You won't have heard a word of that on the BBC. Because the fact is that, in actual fact, that in the Middle East itself, it is widely understood that these extreme Sunni, Salafi, Takfiri groups are aligned with Saudi Arabia, who is aligned with us. We are the sponsors of these groups. And then, of course, we say, ooh, this is terrible, we'll have to intervene. And that's what the whole game's about. Well, we breed foxes in the coverts because we like fox hunting.
Moving on to the story of the tragic plane crash, where it now looks as if one of the pilots flew the aircraft into the Alps as a sort of sinister suicide mission. But this really does throw into light the rules which were brought in after the 9/11 attacks, Martin, doesn't it? Because it looks here as if this entire so-called safety procedure has completely backfired.
Well, the idea is that people in the plane shouldn't be able to break into the cockpit of planes because 19 hijackers with box cutters apparently hijacked four planes on 9/11. Although none of the hijackers appeared on any of the passenger manifests, and various people who claimed who were the named hijackers then appeared in things like the Daily Telegraph and BBC saying, "Well, I wasn't there. I'm still alive." You'd have thought also with three skyscrapers collapsing in their own footprints in one day, you might have closed down all the skyscrapers around the world because they're obviously unsafe. With all of this stuff is chicken, the sky's dark with chickens coming home to roost, isn't it?
Staying with Germany, we heard the NATO's cop killers speech. This is an interview which was done by Julian Charles from the website The Mind Renewed, when he spoke to the author of NATO's Secret Armies, Daniela Ganser. We're going to hear in a minute his discussion about the German Red Army faction and the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany. We're taking a bit of a leap there, back into time, but this is actually quite important, isn't it? If you're looking at Germany, they're certainly not squeaky clean when it comes to these state terrorism that's been going on in Europe.
Well, it's NATO that's really the problem. I mean, Herrhausen, who was Chancellor Kohl's right-hand man, who went backwards and forwards talking to Gorbachev. There was a discussion going on between the Germans and the Russians at that stage about how to bring the Berlin Wall down, how to end the Cold War, and then develop economic ties. And Herrhausen was kidnapped and assassinated by the Red Army faction. And my old friend, Washington's global gamble, Peter Gowan, he said, well, that basically the Red Army faction were the Americans. So Herrhausen is assassinated because he's doing deals with the, you know, doing deals behind the scenes between Chancellor Kohl and Gorbachev, and the Red Army faction then kidnap him and assassinate him because, or somebody claiming to be the Red Army faction, because that's how these things are done.
Well, let's hear Daniela Ganzer talking about the NATO's secret armies over in Germany, the 1980 Munich bombing particularly, and he's being interviewed here by Julian Charles from The Rhind Renewed.
In Germany, obviously, we had this terrorist attack in 1980 in Munich. And there's a huge debate right now going on. The Generalbundesanwalt, who is actually the guy who can research this terrorist attack, has now said that they reopened the case. So now in 2015, they're looking at the case again, because there you have people who've carried out the attack. The main story being that it was just one crazy man and he was all alone and, you know, he blew himself up, so the case is closed.
But familiar.
We've heard that before, haven't we? Or, you know, two crazy guys who commit a crime in Paris and now are dead and can't be questioned. Yeah, but yeah. What I want to say about Germany in 1980 is Gundulf Köhler is the guy who's dead and who, you know, the official narrative says was the lonely man who carried out the attack. But the interesting thing in Germany is that you also had a secret army, the secret stay behind army in Germany. But in 1980, when the attack occurred, obviously nobody knew about the existence of the secret army. But in 1981, a huge arms cache was discovered in Germany. And some right-wing extremists in Germany have said, you know, we took our explosives from this arms cache, the explosive for Munich. And now that's the tricky thing. If you want to set up a secret army in Western Europe, you obviously have to equip it with explosives. I mean, you have to do that. In case Western Europe is occupied by the Soviet Union, they have to be able to blow up bridges and so on. I mean, explosives is what you need if you want to have a guerrilla. You can't give them just paper and a pencil to
presumably they have to be hidden somewhere so that they can get hold of them, but then there's no, where's the control over that?
That's it. That's exactly the point. I mean, if you have a democratic system, you don't want explosives and weapons and ammunition uncontrolled. You don't want that. But that was exactly necessary to have these secret networks. And in Germany, the intriguing thing is that you had people who were former Nazis who were recruited into this stay behind network because NATO or the CIA said, gee, these guys hate the Russians. That's very good, you know?
That's incredible. Yes, I noticed that in the Frankovich documentary, and I was astonished that the guy was testifying that is what had actually happened.
Oh, many cases. They said, we want somebody who's very solidly anti-communist. And the former SS guy said, hey, gee, I apply. That's me. And, you know, my students sometimes ask me, I don't understand it anymore. Weren't they fighting the fascists? And when they won against them, they put them in front of the Nuremberg trials and they basically hanged them or said them, you now have to change. And I say, yeah, sure. You know, that's the official story and that's also true.
Unless they were useful.
Yes, that's the bottom line. Some were useful. And those were not hanged, and they were not tried. And the most interesting guy there, obviously, is Reinhard Gehlen. I mean, he was fighting under Hitler. Then at the end of the war, he found out Hitler was losing it, okay? And he decided to switch sides. So he made sure that the Americans who found him knew that he was an important general, and they flew him to Washington, to Truman, who at the time was the president of the United States. And then this German Nazi general, Gehlen, says to Truman, hi, I could be useful to you because I've heard that we share an enemy, Moscow, the Soviet Union. And then Truman said, yeah, maybe you could be useful because, you know, Germany is one difficult territory and you obviously know it very well. And he said, oh, yes, I know it very well. And then he said, okay, you can be the first boss of the German Secret Service. And they made him the director of the Bundesnachrichtendienst. And it's insane. And when you read this as a student, you go like, how does that? They defeat Hitler first and then they take a Nazi and make him the director of the Secret Service in Germany. How does it add up? And it's actually only adding up in exactly that way that you said. things that are useful, things that are strategically useful are still being done.
It's funny in a way. I mean, it's horrendous, but it's also funny in a way. It reminds me immediately of those films that say a James Bond film, you know, where somebody says, no, don't kill them. They might be useful to us. And it turns out to be true.
Yes. I mean, that's, you know, as a kid, I watched James Bond. I thought it was wonderful, fascinating, everything. I mean, I have this fascination for special forces and secret services. Yeah. But then you watch it and you know, then you switch to BBC News. and then you think, oh, now there's a completely different world. Whereas, in fact, everything that you have in James Bond is taken from reality. It's just not your actual analysis what's actually going on. That's the one thing. And the second thing, which is not true, is it's not always NATO which is the good guy. And obviously we like to have this narrative of us being the good guys and the Soviets or the Muslims being the bad guys. But sometimes it's exactly the other way around, and then we don't want to hear it.
That was Daniele Ganza there, and he's the author of NATO's Secret Armies, talking there to the guy who does a website called The Mind Renewed.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
One of the recurring themes here on The Politics Show is the growing power of money over our courts and our media, whether our society delivers justice, and what we see and hear in our national discourse. With Ken Clark's legal aid cuts, it now costs thousands of pounds just to challenge a former employer, for example, for unfair dismissal. While we have hundreds of digital channels, our mass media seems to be more and more remote from wider public concerns and owned by those who in some ways don't represent us. Meanwhile, the internet has enabled almost anybody to make a film, and if it's good enough for it to be seen all over the world by as many people maybe as would have seen it on the old mainstream TV. But how much can we trust about what we see on the internet? Or is that a good thing? That we should actually work out for ourselves who's telling the truth and who isn't. So rather than harping on as we usually do about this and the miscarriages of justice or other stories which have been misreported or not reported at all, tonight we look at the structural changes in investigative journalism over the last 30 years or so, since the explosion of TV channels and the so-called digital revolution. I'm joined in the studio by two journalists you might never have heard of, but they're two of the hardest hitting journalists in this region. One is the writer Phil Chamberlain, senior journalism lecturer at the University of the West of England, who, with Dave Smith, has just produced a book called Blacklisting, The Secret War Between Big Business and Union Activists. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
And also, the other is author and film producer Tim Tate, who's made documentaries for ITV and other organisations, and global satellite channels, in fact, including the banned Conspiracy of Silence about Child Sexual Abuse in the US Republican Party, and has written books on child sex abuse as well. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
We asked them both then, is investigative journalism dead? Welcome, gentlemen. Phil, can we start with you? What's your answer to that basic question?
No, I think far from being dead, I think it's healthy, vibrant. It's just morphed into lots of different types of forms. So we may have wanted to take a pulse of one body a few years ago. I think now we've got investigative journalism existing and mutated into a number of different forms. So we've got our pulse beating in a number of different ways, which I think is quite exciting.
Okay, which different ways? Obviously, there's the internet. Is that it?
Well, I think that's quite a broad, even just kind of saying the internet. You're broadcasting on radio, but online as well. We're thinking about within Bristol, just on its own, Bristol Cable launching with a remit to investigate stories, not part of the mainstream media, however you may define that, but something that's welled up from below. You're looking at people producing films independently, being broadcast online or shown in community centres elsewhere. It obviously still exists in network television. Perhaps not to the same degree as it may have done, but the audience has moved, and so have the platforms as well. But I think in whichever way you're looking at it, whether it's NGOs producing their investigative work, individuals producing their investigative work, or the classic national newspaper group of three or four journalists working on a story, I think still exists there in a number of different forms.
Okay, how would you define investigative journalism, and how would you define the mainstream media? You were asking that question yourself. It's not an easy one, is it?
Yeah, I mean, so which question do you want to answer first?
Investigative journalism, how do you define that?
Well, I think, there's a quote from Paul Foote, or I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially Paul Foote, Daily Mirror journalist, ex-Daily Mirror journalist, ex-Private Eye reporter, and investigative journalist, I think I'd hope we'd all kind of agree around this table, someone who works on a number of different issues, miscarriage of justice, down to the classic
Well, he was a hero of mine, I have to say.
I think, as an ideal of someone that you want to work towards, I think is brilliant. He said that all journalism should be investigative journalism. Journalism should be about something that someone doesn't want you to print. And it's a nice ideal, I think, to say that all journalism should be. But that's such a broad term. There's nothing wrong with, there's something very right about attending a council meeting and reporting about the events that took place. Is that investigative? I don't think so. Is it journalism? Yes, it is, and it's important. I think investigative journalism, what separates it out, you could say, would be about its impact on society, would be about the stakes are high, I would suggest, with it, that the time taken to carry it out is often much longer. There's much more investment required. It reveals something which otherwise is hidden, for which there's no evidence other than that you've dragged out. I think it requires original research as opposed to rehashing other people's work. There are a number of different ways, but I'm going to put those up as a rough way of separating out what we might call investigative from other journalism.
Because you can sometimes, can't you, find two stories, maybe done by two completely separate people, but you put them together, you get another completely different impression, and that's quite a difficult task as well. Tim Tate, maybe you could share with us what your thoughts are about defining investigative journalism and whether you think it's dead. I mean, is it clearly there is some going on, but well, what's your view?
I don't think it's dead. I just don't think it's very well.
Yeah, Phil's nodding there.
No, I like the medical analogies we keep going. So.
It's actually dying. And it's dying because it's being starved. I share with Phil pretty much that analysis of what investigative journalism is. I differentiate between reporting and investigative journalism. Reporting is, as you say, going along to a council meeting. It's providing the facts. Investigative journalism is digging up something largely that someone doesn't want you to dig up. It's digging up evidence, solid evidence, not opinion, evidence, and it is challenging. It says, this is wrong, this is the person who's responsible, I will ask those questions of him or her. We used to have an immensely healthy tradition of that in Britain. We don't have that anymore. What we have is an awful lot of babble, an awful lot of rooftop shouting from correspondents, merely repeating what the news desk has told them to say. We have less and less inquiring journalism, and I think there are systemic reasons for that, but above all, I think that is a very, very dangerous thing for our democracy.
Well, why is it so dangerous, Tim?
It goes back to the classic problem of the United Kingdom. We don't have a written constitution. We have a constitutional arrangement by which there are, crudely, four branches of power. There's the executive, that's whoever's in number 10 at the time. There's the legislative, that's the Houses of Commons and Parliament. There's the judiciary, obviously the courts. The fourth estate is the media, the press as it used to be called. Each one of those is there under our slightly wobbly constitutional table to keep an eye on the other one, to act as a brake on the other one's power. If you take one of those legs away, that table is going to wobble and eventually fall over. And what has happened is we have dumbed down and reduced the inquiring watchdog nature of the fourth estate.
Phil, Tim's there saying that we've dumbed things down. What you're saying is actually that we've spread things out. There's more going on, but I think, paraphrasing what Tim's saying, he's saying, although there's more stuff out there, it's a babble, and it's difficult to actually make sense of.
Yeah, it's probably two things, and I think taking on this point about the going to the council meeting to report and then asking the difficult questions. So that, as Tim raised, I think there are two points that come out of that. One is asking the difficult question. That requires courage. It requires a commitment and someone to back you up to ask that. If you ask difficult questions of people who have authority and power, you need to have the support to be able to do that. And Tim also said about digging out evidence. I think absolutely right. I think what tends to be a character is a mass of evidence for story. The classic iceberg, that 90% of what you've gathered lies behind the 10% that actually makes it onto whatever platform you've produced. And doing that requires resources, and the economic setup at the moment doesn't quite often want to resource in the mainstream media investigative reporting, because it annoys people who have power and who have expensive lawyers, and it takes a long time, and sometimes it doesn't produce anything, even if you know there's something there, but you're not quite able to stand it up. So it requires a commitment of courage and resources, I think you would say. And in these times where the BBC has to increasingly justify what it's going to do along commercial grounds, investigative journalism is a bet, something they sometimes don't wish to bet on, I think you would say. So that's, I think, part of the issue about why there's a problem at the moment. What I'm interested in is that still stories find their way out, that people aren't willing to accept that there isn't any other way of reporting it, and finding and developing their own means of telling those kind of stories.
I'm going to disagree with pretty much most of what you've said and you're going to say, I suspect.
Okay,
evening.
Cool.
I think you can date the malaise in investigative journalism very, very precisely. It dates back to a single documentary film on ITV called Death on the Rock. For those old enough to remember, it was a Thames television production which accused the government of ordering a shoot-to-kill policy for suspected IRA terrorists on Gibraltar. It incensed Margaret Thatcher. This is not supposition, this is fact. It incensed her so much that she said, I am going to change the way that British television operates. And in doing so, she was absolutely determined that there would not be another Death on the Rock. It took a while for that to happen, but what she did was change the structure, the very delicate ecosystem of British broadcasting, to ensure that there would be less and less investigative journalism.
So how did she do that?
It's pretty simple. Before Death on the Rock, and until very shortly thereafter, if you wanted to have the franchise to broadcast in ITV, because ITV was then a system of 15 regional companies, you had to bid for it, and you had to bid both on financial grounds, but you also had to bid on quality grounds. There was a quality threshold, and you had to say, to get this license from you, the government, I will broadcast X number of programmes which are strongly journalistic, X number of documentaries, X number of arts, history, religious films. There was a written down, legally binding contract which says this is what I will do. Thatcher abolished that. Once the quality threshold was gone, it was pretty simple for ITV companies to look at this and say, you know, I don't really need to do this anymore. And successive governments have removed every last piece, every last requirement for ITV to broadcast anything other than what they choose to broadcast. What they choose to broadcast, though, by and large, is bread and circuses. It's entertainment shows, because that's where the money is. That's where the audiences are, the big audiences are, and that's therefore where the advertisers are. That's great, but it's not public service broadcasting. Once ITV began to pull away from that, Channel 4 said, we don't have to do that. And they started filling their schedules with property porn instead of serious programmes. Once Channel 4 and ITV had done that, the BBC came under greater pressure. Well, you're not getting the huge audiences. Why do you have the licence fee, which is a tax? Because you're not giving the people what they want. The result is that there has been a significant and continual lowering of the bar, so that whilst investigative programmes do get through, they're frankly now rarer than hen's teeth. Broadcasting doesn't exist on its own, it affects newspapers. There's a symbiotic relationship. The whole thing folded in on itself.
But Tim, what you're ignoring there is what Phil's pointing out, which is the absolute explosion on the internet. I mean, for example, even a film that you made that was banned by a Discovery Channel on international television has found it onto the internet. There it is.
And that's great. I have no problem with that, though I didn't send it to the internet, I would stress, in case Discovery's lawyers might be listening. What I'm saying to you is that is never, ever, ever going to fill the gap, and there are two reasons. The first is what Phil's alluded to, which is a financial thing. I've spent most of the 37 years I've been in this trade as an investigative journalist. An investigation takes time and money. The funding is not there to do this on the internet. No one's investing that money in it. Therefore, it isn't going to get done. Or if it's done, it's done by lone wolves, people who say, well, I'm going to do this because I care enough to do it, and I'll figure out how to put food on the table later. That's the first problem. The second problem is there is a myth that is peddled that audiences, consumers, as they're now called, for investigative journalists, have migrated away from the mainstream media to the internet. And do you know what? There isn't a single piece of empirical evidence to show that to be true.
Phil, what do you make of that? Because I think Tim's making a pretty strong case. He's saying that there's simply not the money to fund these investigations, especially when, you know, you may have a whole team of people plus a barrister working on something for a week or a month or even longer, and then find, well, we can't actually broadcast it. There's simply not the money around to do
which
that.
Which is what I said earlier.
Yeah.
I think we're not disagreeing on that.
No, we're agreeing on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes it, is that they are complex, and therefore you have to, you require, someone's got to take a punt on it. You know, so, I mean, it's not going to, the fact that it may not even produce something to air because at the last stage something comes up, it doesn't quite come together. That's, The property prawn you talked about, absolutely, I know it's going to happen. It's a safe bet for me to invest in. So that's why they're going to go for it. I absolutely agree. I think that there are a couple of things there. One is about the idea of the lone wolves. I think actually there have always been kind of lone wolves, and I
don't think there's any problem with lone wolves. I'd largely class myself as one,
yeah.
But
I suppose saying in the babble of voices, actually, it's difficult to get them to get the herd, and to get heard in that way. That's about nature of trust, I think, and the fracturing of audiences and where people get information from. You're specifically talking about public serving broadcasting and dating it to the death on the rock. This is quite a kind of well-established kind of case about how Margaret Thatcher took a revenge on someone having the temerity to question their actions. And there obviously has been a decline. If you want to just count up the programmes that are no longer with us, you know, we can all reel off a couple ourselves. But they still exist. I mean, Panorama still comes out on a weekly basis. Are you going to reach for a piece of paper now?
Yeah, well, I'm going to read out the list that Tim sent me of 10 different investigative programmes. I think these were, apart from First Tuesday, were weekly. Panorama, Brass Tacks, Inside Story, World in Action, First Tuesday,
World in Action Viewpoint. World in Action been replaced by Tonight.
Viewpoint, The Cook Report, This Week on ITV, Dispatches and Secret History, and I would add to that Rough Justice as well.
There's a difference, actually. I think there's an interesting one about miscarriage of justice as a specific strand. I think actually that's been done hardly anywhere, miscarriage of justice. And I think there's a whole interesting thing going on about the Criminal Cases Review Commission, there's a wider discussion thing about miscarriages, but they're not being covered in the same way. It used to be, if you're investigative, you weren't one until you had a miscarriage of justice thing under your belt. Do you know what I mean? And they don't, not pursued in that same way. The last one I saw bumping overturned was actually partly as a result of work by students at an incident project at the University of Cardiff. It was interesting what was coming out of that as opposed to from the mainstream media as such. The programmes are all outlets have always arisen, flourished, and moved on again. There are outlets from the 19th century which did amazing stuff, and they're no longer with us. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen on print. There are radio programmes which used to produce stuff and are no longer with us. They're in different kind of forms. There is a decline in the totality number. The Cook Report is no longer with us. There are a number of programmes which still look at consumer issues. Cook Report is very much that, you know, the person overturned by a kind of company or something. That they're picked up by different programmes. World in Action is no longer... Is there left on network? Absolutely. But It's still there on a regular basis. Has the threshold, the public service threshold, been lowered? Absolutely. I would agree with that. But again, we're looking at quite a narrow kind of focus. And indeed, if I look on my programme guide, I pull my programme guide up and I see Made in Bristol at number 8. It's a kind of local TV station as well. But also, if I scroll a bit further down, I see Al Jazeera with the whole investigations unit producing material. I can tune into to CNN. I can tune into a number of other places as well. So I think while these programmes would have been on, that would also have been the same time, because I'm not that far off from Tim as well, where having a fourth channel was still something of a luxury on television. Actually, I've now got, now there's the classic 50 channels, nothing on, but there's actually been a broadening of the number of channels open as well.
Let's just have a look at the Cook Report specifically, because this is one of the things that I find just mind-boggling. 10 million viewers a week he was pulling in, and there was a scrap with the News of the World, a legal scrap. I mean, if a current affairs programme like that, effectively a kind of journalistic sting operation, can pull in 10 million viewers, why aren't the networks doing that still?
Yeah, that's a, sorry, I'm self-dominant.
Well, I mean, I should declare an interest. I used to work on the Cook Report, and I worked with Roger for many years and did his last major film for ITV in 2007. And I can tell you exactly why the networks don't want that type of journalism, and I can give you cast iron examples of what they say when you offer them to them, because that's what I do for a living. They don't want it because you have to spend a lot of money. This stuff ain't cheap to make. You equally have to spend a lot of money on lawyers.
Ugh.
And the lawyers are even more expensive than the programmes in many cases. You mentioned Jazeera. I worked for Jazeera as well for 4 years. I finally made a film. One of the films I made for them was an hour-long investigation into Boeing. Boeing's a $58 billion a year company. It's the second biggest aircraft company in the world. It's a pretty big target. I had thousands of documents and whistleblowers showing that Boeing had knowingly put 1,600 of the most commonly used passenger planes up in the sky with parts which its own paperwork showed to be unlawful and ill-fitting. I took that first to Dispatches at Channel 4, and Dispatches is what it claims to be the investigative current affairs programme on television. The commissioning editor for Dispatches then said, and I quote in an email, "You can't make these sort of allegations about a well-respected international company." Now, leaving aside the fact that's what investigative journalism should do, he didn't ask, "Have you got the evidence?" He just said, "You can't do it." Now, we did make the film. I made it for Jazeera, and it was shown around the world, and I hope it has made a difference. It worries me when you have a commissioning editor for a soi-disant investigative flagship program who says you can't really accuse big companies of doing something wrong. That man, he's no longer the commissioning editor there, he's now a senior executive in charge of programming at Vice, which is one of the sprouting internet-based organizations. Has he carried that same attitude across to this? If so, it doesn't bode well for the internet picking up what we used to do.
Also, Phil, I mean, I know you've just, in the process of, I'm not sure if it's been published yet, doing this book about blacklisting called Blacklisted.
It's been published 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
can you tell us how that process went? Obviously, you put a lot of time and effort into writing the book, but how about getting it published? Was that an easy process?
It's my first book, so I don't know whether that's the yardstick to test by all publication books. There are probably experts out there that have had easier and tougher journeys than Dave and I did. Was it easy to get published? The contract was easy to do. Was it easy to get past the lawyers? No, it wasn't. But then you are investigating 44 of the largest construction companies in the UK and accusing them of systematic human rights abuse. You're going to get some kind of pushback on that.
Good. I mean, rightly, frankly.
I would be a bit disappointed if we hadn't actually, because we wonder about whether you're not asking the right questions, to be honest. I think it's... I can go about blacklisting, that's fine. Tim raised an interesting point there. I mean, do you not see as a... The fact the film still got made, so it still gets heard and broadcast, you know, he or she, that person, you know, kind of personalised or something, makes probably what we think is a wrong call on that for whatever reason. It still gets kind of published. But do you think, in which case, I would be concerned if every time I saw that particular programme, I'm not here paid to be an advocate for network television by any stretch of the imagination, but on the other hand, there are corporations that are hit by these programmes every now and again, and therefore it's as if they always kind of back off. Now, you could say in a kind of Chomsky's way that that just merely proves the system is working by every now and again correcting a small dysfunctional part, because it proves that the oversight is working. We can get into that kind of meta-analysis if you wish, but you know, they do actually every now and again manage to kind of take on some of the big boys.
I have a lot of patience for Al Jazeera, and not just because I worked for them for 4 years. I think they do fantastic work. The big question is not whether Al Jazeera is doing great work, and it is. The question is, why have we got a situation where public service broadcasting in this country relies on a Doha-based network to do our job for us? And just to pick that point up, just before we came out, I picked up the 40 most recent programmes that Dispatches, for whom I also used to make films, broadcast. Rice, how safe is our food? Are you addicted to your doctor?
No.
Benefits Britain, the British property boom. If that is investigative journalism, I am a banana.
Phil, what do you think? I mean, the list that Tim's read out there, does that fit into your category of investigative journalism?
Well, it's at 3 out of 40, but I think there has been a change, isn't there? I think about kind of ideas about consumer reporting, and if anything about that, I think the Cook Report is part of that, to be honest. You know, about what class is as investigative about taking on kind of consumer issues. I'm not here to defend one way or the other, but I think there have been a change in taste that go on as well. There have been plenty of other programmes that they've done which have tackled far more serious subjects, you know, however you may wish to define that. Well, I think that
could you
probably
just name
you would say
me a couple of them?
No, I don't have to. Well, I'm interested about Benefits Britain, for instance, one being a multi-billion-pound industry which affects millions of people in this country. Yeah, I think that's probably something that's worth investigating.
Yeah, I mean, also one of the big stories right now is this child sexual abuse scandal, Whitehall Westminster scandal.
Yeah, and that's interesting actually, because first of all, I think we need to kind of take the internet as some kind of warehouse somewhere with some wires going in and out of it. It's far too simplistic as being described. Actually, we've got a number of different being viewed on a number of different platforms, produced a number of different ways across all across online, or being known as online radio, and all sorts of different kind of platforms. And one of the drivers for this current investigation around child sex abuse is an outfit called Exaro News, which is online only. And is led by a chap called Mark Watts, who comes from the traditional, and putting my kind of air quotes up and stuff, print media and stuff, and has gone on online. It's trying to work out a business model that will work. Zaro's done some incredible work in pushing this and asking questions and taking the time to investigate, to take on some of the hits, quite often in conjunction with papers like the Sunday People as well. I think that's one of the interesting developments.
There's a tension there, Phil, isn't there? Because we also had Newsnight spiking the story, which was the Jimmy Savile witnesses and people who had been abused by Savile were spiked. Liz McKean, who did the interview,
How do you know about being spiked?
Well, the program wasn't played because
How do you know that?
Well, because a bit of investigative journalism.
Right. Okay. So, this stuff doesn't kind of lie under a rock and is kind of hidden away secretly. The BBC in that case made a monumental error for which they have been roundly kind of chastised.
Anyway, well, I'm trying to.
The point is that you only know that because other journalists are kind of asking those questions about it.
Well,
Zaro News is one of those that's pulling out the error in not kind of pursuing that. It's been kind of corrected elsewhere.
And also, to be fair, Miles Gosler, who wrote up the story of what happened at Newsnight, had gone around all the mainstream newspapers in London and failed to get it in. Eventually it went out in the Oldie magazine. But anyway, look, this is a subject that Tim's covered in his documentary Conspiracy of Silence in the US. So let's hear a little clip from that now, a very short clip from Tim's film.
you literally have to have bricks for brains to take on the FBI in this country. And that's exactly what you'd have to do this properly. They now, in my opinion, in my investigation, are the architects of the cover-up.
We asked the FBI for an interview about its investigation of the Franklin scandal.
Larry Holmquist with the FBI here. We feel it would be inappropriate for us to comment. We work this with the Omaha Police Department. We just don't feel it would be appropriate for us to make comments.
As the phone slammed down by the FBI there. Tim, how is making that film, maybe you can tell us when it was made, how has it, you think, affected the way you've seen what's unfolded here with post-Jimmy Savile?
I made the film back in 1994 for Discovery, and Discovery funded it, and Discovery eventually, a week before broadcast, decided they weren't going to broadcast it for reasons you and I have gone into on other programs. I'd like to draw something, a lesson out of that, and refer to Ixaro, whom you've celebrated, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news on this, but Ixaro has, frankly, a pretty shoddy track record on this subject. And I say that, and Mr. Watts knows, because he and I have disagreed very loudly about this. To my certain knowledge, and to his certain knowledge, it has twice published stories which were factually utterly incorrect on this, and set hairs running which had thereafter to be shot. The second point is, if you look at what Ixaro has done recently on this subject, and what it trumpets as its achievements, it has done no more than people used to do on the tabloids in the 70s and 80s. It has interviewed anonymously someone who said, this happened to me in this place by these people who will also remain anonymous. There is no evidence in Ixaro's reporting that it has undertaken any due diligence to find out whether that's true or not. It has merely reported an allegation by an anonymous complainant against anonymous alleged offenders. I have no idea whether that's true or not, and I don't think Ixaro does either. But what I do know is that isn't investigative journalism. When I made the Franklin film, that you've just played a clip from, I had, because I had the money and the time to do this, a room full of grand jury testimonies. Now, there's an element of having to own up that I'm not actually allowed to have those, but for me to support and to say to Discovery or whoever else, here is somebody making this allegation, I want some evidence to support it. And my great worry about the Ixaros of this world is all they are doing is reporting. They're saying, here is someone making an allegation. We're not telling you whether it's true or not. We're merely saying it's an allegation that's been made, and we can't tell you who made it, and we can't tell you who it relates to. I don't think that's investigative journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Phil, what Tim's saying there is again, this kind of accusation of there being too much babble out there without... I mean, in the old days when there were only...
I don't think he's saying that. I think he's questioning the methodology behind Ixaro, if I'm correct about that.
You know, I have to say I'm not particularly blaming Ixaro for doing it. I think it's going to be a great business model for them, because it was a proven business model for the tabloids, the tabloid Sundays, for many decades. What I am saying is, don't please confuse this with serious investigative journalism, because it isn't.
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm kind of here as the paid representative for investigative outlets, and that's not what I'm about. What I'm interested in, the fact that its stories forcing their way out, despite the rather narrow definition that if it's only on television and on 9 o'clock at night with a single word headline, that therefore it's classed as investigative journalism. I think it's much broader than that. Ixaro is not defined by the Savile scandal. I've spoken to Mark Watts, come down to talk to students, and I'm actually one of the cases they kind of cut their teeth on, if you like, was, if I recall, about the self-employment status for senior civil servants and the way they were being paid, analysis of their kind of tax returns about the fact they were avoiding tax by being paid as limited companies. So Zara can answer for their own kind of methodology about how they carry out investigations. I think tabloids have traditionally deployed dubious methods to gain, and have always have done since you know, the kind of 19th century, about how they kind of gain stories. That's because there are different markets out there looking for serving markets in different ways. People looking for stories that they feel are applicable to them. Not everybody is interested in a particular like American story. Some people are more interested in much more maybe mundane matters in different ways. So you know, there are different approaches depending on which market you're targeting. I wouldn't expect to be able to kind of see a similar type appearing. I do think it's interesting, Zorro, kind of the way it's kind of stepping up at the moment. That's all.
Tim, does investigative journalism actually change anything? Good investigative journalism?
Yes, it can. Simple, obvious examples. Watergate is the granddaddy of them all. Watergate changed things kind of dramatically. From my own personal experience, yes, a film that I made got the law changed. Yes, it can do, but to do that, you have to have the evidence. You have to have spent the time and the money assembling the evidence which makes a watertight case. It's like a prosecution. It's not enough just to use the old analogy, to walk into a crowded theatre and shout fire. You actually have to have a reasonable degree of evidence that there is a fire.
I think about going back to right back to the beginning, which is about definitions. If it's really going to reach that satisfy our demand about what is it, then I think unless it has changed something, then is it investigative? I think ultimately, I mean, everything may aspire to it, but until perhaps it has changed people's ways of thinking or ways of behaving, then that might be one of defining is it investigative?
I know, to some extent, your listeners may think, oh, this is all a bit inside baseball, you know, it's, you know, what does it really matter? And here's why I think it matters, and the Xaro, again, is a potentially good example. Again, I stress, I don't know whether the stories that Xaro are publishing are true or not, and I don't believe Xaro knows whether they're true or not. They may believe them to be true, but they haven't got the evidence, or if they have, they haven't published it. What they are doing is raising public expectation. And if that public expectation is not met, in other words, no prosecutions ensue, no one is found guilty or named for it, you exacerbate the growing problem, which I see, and I think you must see, in which the public don't just distrust their media, but distrust every aspect of government. I think if you're going to shout fire, you've got to have the evidence.
Although I think that's one of the arguments about Watergate, wasn't it? They were saying you were destroying trust in the government, etc. like that. But it had to be. I mean, just saying,
but
that's what gets
the
deployed. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Watergate's. Are we running up close to the time?
Yeah, I was just going to mention Michael Hastings, because he's an investigative journalist and is investigating exactly the same sort of stuff as came out in the Watergate scandal, which was the intelligence services actually spying on the government and using, also spying on journalists around that. So when you've got your own domestic security service targeting politicians, elected politicians and journalists, you've got quite a serious situation, as they have in the US. But I'd like to wind up, guys, by asking you both, if you had a 1980s style budget for an hour long documentary.
Is that with inflation?
Yep, with inflation hardwired in there.
And expenses, please.
With your QC sitting there twiddling his thumbs for a week, just so that you can make sure that your program's legally watertight, or maybe a couple of weeks. But for making an hour-long documentary, what sort of stuff would you like to see and would you enjoy making, Phil?
I think what journalism doesn't do very well, excuse me, what journalism does do very well with long-term trends, I think it's very good at incidents that take place, and Watergate is an example of that, and then trying to work out context. I'm trying to be brief here. But so where, if you've got that time, I think, is to look at some long-term trends. How is it that we wake up and Tesco, as was, is suddenly the biggest kind of supermarket? You know, it kind of creeps up on you, and then suddenly you realise it's there. And so I think what would be nice to have that time to be able to track some of those long-term economic trends. How is it about how our manufacturing base develops, or what is it about the environment that we want to look at? Because journalism increasingly is still based around the kind of now, the event that happens now, and looking at it in a very narrow context. So if I had the time, it's a very broad answer, It's the ability to be able to track over a longer term and then think about what structurally is problem with mass media society.
Yeah, to take a step back from the story and take a longer view,
put
it into context.
Not just go to the council meeting, but to think about how is it they came to the decision, to extend that analogy.
The why as well as the what.
Right.
Can I ask you the same question then, Tim? If you could make a programme, an hour-long programme, stuck on prime time terrestrial TV, if such a thing still exists, really, it's all digital now, isn't it? But here in Britain, what would you make?
Well, I'm going to be weaselly about this because that's what I still do for a living, and I'm not actually going to announce what I would like to do next. I'm just finishing one film at the moment. Can I ask a question instead, which is classic investigative journalism by my colleagues, former colleagues at Yorkshire Television and at Granada Television, resulted in the freeing of 10 innocent men, the Birmingham 6 and the Guildford 4. I ask a simple question. Who would do that now?
Private Eye?
No, they wouldn't. It took 3 years for each of those teams to do that. It took many hundreds of thousands of pounds. Private Eye can't do that.
A book by Chris Mullin involved as well. I mean, parliamentarians.
Chris Mullin was paid by World in Action
research. Oh yeah, look, I mean, I'm not decrying the efforts there. I think it would still kind of burst out. The book that Dave Smith and I have written, Blacklisted, is as a result of some The Guardian, primarily a little bit of the Daily Mirror doing a little bit of work, but primarily the work of myself and Dave working independently with a couple of lawyers, with a couple of with a number of union activists, with some NGO help, working out that work collectively and then publishing it and resulting that in a series of investigations that are kind of carrying on. I mean, I think that stuff can still sprout out. I just don't need to wait until I get the okay from the mainstream media to say that it's okay to investigate.
Time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. You were just listening to Phil Chamberlain from the University of the West of England and Tim Tate, former documentary maker for ITV.
Current documentary maker, if you will.
Current? All right, current documentary maker.
Sorry.
Our sister show Dialects on Mondays at 11 a.m. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, leader of the Lib Dems and councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to Joe Martin from the Bristol Cannabis Club and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Stephen Sizer, the band Reverend. We didn't have time for him. We'll have him next week. And we're online at thisweek.org.uk. See you at 5 next Friday.